Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele podcast. This has been so much fun, and it's so nerdy and so forward thinking in so many ways. I love it. Sarah always brings the A game in the conversation around really how voters are thinking and feeling about a lot of stuff out there. Oftentimes, the media just glosses over or just pejoratively kind of puts it all in one bucket. Sarah takes it out the bucket, lays it out very plain, like your mama laying out your clothes in the morning. Here are your underwear, your socks. Here are your pants. Here's your shirt. There's your jacket. So now you put them all in order. You understand what you're going to look like when you're fully dressed. That's what Sarah does with politics. I love it. So you had, to sum up on the Dems, what from what you've seen out there and how you're looking at the landscape, what would be some of the advice you would give them to navigate with these voters to begin to pull their attention towards the success of the economy, the success in foreign policy, the success in infrastructure, the success in abating inflation and high interest rates as best that they can? How would you advise them at this point to take their head out of their ass, look at what America is telling them they're concerned about, and addressing that?
Yeah. So this has been my advice all along. So one of the things that I keep trying to explain to Democrats, because Democrats are like, but here's the good news. And we passed the infrastructure bill and here's what was in it. And let me tell you why this is so great. And I'm like, let me tell you, your voters on your side don't know any about this. Swing voters don't know. Like, nobody knows about any of this. And they're like, but we're running ads. And so my big frustration with the Democrats' communications capabilities is like, look, you guys know Joe Biden's not going to be your lead communicator. It's not what he's good at. Why don't you have an army of surrogates out there telling this story? When Donald Trump was doing this, like, Donald Trump would go out and be like, best economy for Black people, best economy for women, best economy for you, how's your 401k? And then every other Republican would say like the exact same thing. We moved this to Israel, you know what? And everybody was singing from the same song sheet. Joe Biden does not have that chorus. And you know what? I do not care at all for Gavin Newsom. He's not my cup of tea among the Democrats, but he is the only one out there. Yep. He's mixing it up with, you know, the Fox News hosts. He's getting into debates. He's defending Biden's record. And there should be 100 other people doing that too. This is, I'm like, this is part of my frustration with but somebody else would be so much better. I'm like, I have not seen Warnock or Whitmer.
No.
Like, they're not out there defending this, making the case, becoming high profile surrogates. They should. They need to. And so I've never understood that. So that is my advice, is like, everyone needs to warm up their voices and get out there and become part of the chorus to help Joe Biden out. He's the idea that everyone just sits around criticizing Biden for being old. Like, fine, show them all the young faces of the party. Show them who's around them. Paint a different picture. They can all control that.
Show those young faces supporting Joe Biden, because that negates this whole, oh my God, he's so old. Because you're saying, yeah, he is, but he's Uncle Joe, he's Grandpa Joe. And so he's still viable. He's still important to what we need to do. And as long as he is, I'm behind him. I'm supporting him. He's done these things that no one else in the Democratic Party has done since Lyndon Johnson. And regardless of whether you like it from a policy standpoint or not, Democrats have been successful because Joe Biden was successful at doing what Joe Biden does. I mean, I go back and I remember just telling just a group of Democrats at a dinner, dude, he negotiated Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security off the debt limit table. right? When we were talking about the debt limit, he stood in the well of the Congress, looked those Republicans in the eye and said, oh, so you guys agree with me. We're not going to touch Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. And they stood up and applauded. Yo, no, we're not doing it. He was like, okay, we're good.
I forgot about that moment. That was a good moment.
That was a great moment. And these idiots didn't even know how to talk about the moment that he just given him and run with that to begin to your earlier point, grind down the narrative that Joe Biden, A, is too old, and B, has accomplished nothing.
Yeah. I totally, and it's actually quite annoying to see people like Brian Kemp and other Republicans, like they're all standing behind Donald Trump tried a coup. Like he did, he like presided over a million people dying of COVID, and every Republican's like, oh yeah, I'll still vote for him. Oh yeah, I'll support him if he's the nominee. Joe Biden did none of those bad things, did some pretty good things. And you'd think that Democrats would be like rallying to his defense. Instead, they all sit around like, you know, twisting their arms and letting and giving their voters permission to do the same. Right. Like I'm telling you what I'm hearing from voters. But like you, I don't think they realized they could have some control over that narrative if they went out there and really did the job.
So let's shift to the other side of the aisle and the Republican base, which you've touched on a little bit. What I'm curious about now that you've sort of laid out, okay, this is where this base is leaning. So they've kind of locked in on Trump. How does that still and why has it still seemingly kept the Republican leadership from really kind of pushing back on that and pulling at that in a way that says, we can't win with this strategy. It's almost the opposite problem that the Democrats have. They're out there thinking they can't win with success. Republicans are like, we can't win with failure. What is the narrative inside the GOP right now, particularly with the political leadership, given that the RNC, Kevin McCarthy, and his speakership all seem to be beholden and really held captive by a base that is looking at something that is just really utterly earth too?
Yeah. I mean, as best I can tell, what happened is that the Republicans were sure after January 6th, right, that the Trump thing was over, that the fever had broken. And so they didn't impeach him. And they basically set the stage for all of this now to happen. They have at every point hoped for like a cheeseburger or some other exogenous event to come and take Trump out that they don't have to put their hands on and be active participants in. And so there's this major collective action problem. And it's funny, Trump tipped, there was like this phase, right, where they were all like, Trump can't win. He won't be the nominee. You've got, what's his name from New Hampshire, you know, when he decided not
Sununu.
To run. Sununu was like, but he can't win. And Larry Hogan, they all, Paul Ryan, he can't win.
Relax,
He won't be the nominee. He won't be the nominee. And so everybody's kind of like, okay, well, we won't be. But here's the thing, you cannot beat something with nothing.
Right.
And then you look at these field of candidates that are running. They all decided not to attack Trump. They all became bit players in the central drama surrounding Trump because they were all defending him for every indictment that came down. And it's like at some point without noticing, it went from, well, Trump can't win. He can't be the nominee to, well, Trump's definitely the nominee. Now we can't do anything about it.
Right.
And like, I don't know where that middle part was where they all thought there was an opening, but I missed it. They missed it. And now I think they're already back to talking themselves into accepting Trump again. And they're saying, telling themselves things like, well, he can only do one more term. So like, we'll just suck it up for another 4 years. And it's like, I don't know, guys, you may have met the guy. He might not go anywhere. Like he's going to be president till you're dead.
Right. And we are so effed. And the thing that I find that's striking, and I'd be very curious what you're finding here, because the parallel that's beginning to emerge on the Democratic side with Senator Bob Menendez is very intriguing for me. The idea that you have a putative nominee for the Republican Party who is engulfed. I mean, you could not put more gasoline on oneself and light it to be more engulfed than Donald Trump is in the fires of litigation around his behavior and the actions that he took and didn't take on January 6th, that he took and didn't take in his phone call with Raffensperger in Georgia, et cetera. And yet the party is like, it's my man. That's my man. I'm ride or die, you know? Yeah. 6 out of 8 candidates on that stage in the first debate raised their hand and said, yes, if the man is wearing an orange jumpsuit suit with shackles on his legs, I will support him. I will endorse him. And then you have on the other side, Democrats very quickly coming out. I think some, you know, half of the Democrats in the leadership in the Senate and governors around the country saying, Bob Menendez, nah, we're not carrying this water into this election cycle. You need to stand down. Talk a little bit about that contrast in the approach and whether or not the public really appreciates it. And also what it is about the Republicans that they're walking around with a gob of shit on the bottom of their shoe and they refuse to find a curb that they can scrape it all off against.
Yeah. I mean, look, first of all, yeah, there's been a total asymmetry in the way that Democrats have handled their sort of scandals of the last. And that includes, when Me Too was hot, they got rid of Franken rather than they didn't defend him. And they didn't get much credit for that. And in fact, I think a lot of Democrats look at that and they were like, I wish we hadn't done that.
Yeah, they do.
And because that cost us like a real person in the party. but I think with Menendez, like they know right now, whether it's Hunter Biden or Bob Menendez, that they want to do everything they can to present a different picture from Republicans and say that corruption is unacceptable. And I think that's both right politically as well as correct morally.
Right.
The party should not accept corruption within their ranks. And frankly, what party should be doing is holding people accountable. Now, the Republicans basically learned from Donald Trump that by not apologizing and refusing to hold anybody accountable. I mean, at this point, is there something that could get a Republican fired? Is there something that could get a Republican? I mean, George Santos isn't losing anything. Lauren Boebert didn't lose anything. Marjorie Taylor. I mean, you could speak at a white supremacist conference. You know, you could be Paul Gosar.
Or get felt up in an audience somewhere in public.
Yeah. But you can do whatever. And no one. You can lie about everything. Have a million investigations against you. That could be Trump. That could be Santos. Whatever. No one's going to hold you accountable on the right. And so the fact that there is one political party that still is showing any sense around accountability, I think is important because Democrats have to, I think, demonstrate that they are the party for serious people, right? That they can be the big, broad pro-democracy coalition for people who say, like, actually some of this stuff still matters. So I think that's good. The question about whether how much credit they'll get from voters for it, that's a tough one. I wish voters gave people more credit for doing the right thing. Trump's had a heck of a normalizing impact on voters of all kinds for just having a much higher threshold for the nonsense and just like all of it being a circus and people not caring as much. I still think they need to do it.
You think something serious has to happen to your last point that people begin to realize, oh man, I really screwed us up. I got this all wrong. I can't believe that now, you know, my freedoms have been curtailed. Or because you're right, if Donald Trump gets back in, he's already told I'm your retribution. So that means a lot of people are going to, he's already said he wants to kill the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, that he would take him out and have him shot. And I suspect that there's some people in the military who would do that. And we need to be honest about that too. And there's just a lot, my point being, there's just a lot of poison in the system now that, quote, good people that you think would do the right thing and be there like they were in a first Trump term, in a second Trump term, I don't think that goodness is going to be there. I don't think that interest in the national Democratic experiment is going to be there. I think it will be about how do I help Donald Trump repay the wrongs that have been, used against him or the wrongs that he's endured. And at that point, do people go, oh, so that's what you've been trying to tell me for the last 10 years.
Hey, everybody, thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.